Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight, I'm speaking with John Ram, the planning director for the City and County of San Francisco. Now, in the last decade, San Francisco has weathered a great recession, followed by a period of unprecedented growth. And through it all, the city has struggled with a significant housing shortage and widening inequality. Now, during his time in office, John has tackled issues ranging from community stabilization and racial inequality to sea level rise. He has firsthand experience with how politics, public interest, and environmental regulations all impact urban development in the Bay. And after 12 years leading the planning department, John is retiring in February 2020, just coming up in a few months, so he is untethered for this hour. And we will ask him how the city of San Francisco has changed in the last decade and what it will look like in the future. And how is San Francisco balancing growth with issues of transportation, climate change, and equity? So we're very pleased to be joined by John Ram, who was appointed planning director in January of 2008. Prior to this position with the city of San Francisco, John served as associate director in the city of Pittsburgh's planning department and later the planning director for Seattle's Department of Planning and Development. So welcome, John, and congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you, Ethan. It's great to be here.
And we also want to hear from you. We invite listeners to join this conversation. You can do so. We'll open the phone lines in about 20 minutes by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But you can email us in the meantime at cityvisionskalw.org. You can also tweet or post a comment on our Facebook page if you would like to give us a question before the phone lines open about 20 minutes. So, John, let me start by just asking what I'm sure many people would like to know, which is what exactly is the planning director of the city and county of San Francisco? What does that position entail?
Well, the planning director is responsible for overseeing the work of the planning department. It's a position that reports to the planning commission. Planning Commission is appointed 4 members by the mayor, 3 by the Board of Supervisors. The Planning Department is responsible for reviewing development projects and permits and processing entitlements, if you will, for development projects, but also for long-range neighborhood planning policy and legislation related to the planning code. So on the one hand, we're looking at the future and seeing what the city should be like in 30, 40 years. On the other hand, we are also looking on a day-to-day basis as to what is being proposed to be built and making sure it's consistent with the city's codes and with our vision of the future.
And so to put this in maybe a sort of concrete terms for people, no pun intended, let's say I have a development project that I would like to bring forth in the city of San Francisco. Where would the planning director's role fit into that process?
Well, to be clear, the department has a staff of 240 people. So you would come to the department, submit an application, and we would then process it through a series of analyses such as environmental review and then analyzing it against the planning code to make sure it meets the code requirements. It may or may not require approval of a higher level such as the planning commission, or we might be able to approve it in-house depending on where it is, how big it is, and that sort of thing.
And if I'm someone in a neighborhood in San Francisco, what are the kinds of questions that that I might ask of you? How would you affect people who are in neighborhoods now? What is the way that your role and your position changes neighborhoods or might impact neighborhoods?
You mean with respect to development or just
sure,
in
just
general?
If I had a question about the future of my neighborhood, what could you say in terms of how your role affects that?
Well, I mean, we have done in a number of ways. One is related to development. I mean, we require developers, for example, to meet with neighbors before their project moves forward. But I think more significantly, looking long term, we've done a series of neighborhood plans over the last decade or more, really, going back before I arrived, in areas of the city where we thought, and I think we were correct, about where growth was most likely to happen. So the downtown area, south of Market, the southeast quadrants of the city where most of the city's growth is happening, we have conducted a series of fairly detailed plans and changed the zoning in those areas to reflect that those are the areas that where the city will grow, close to transit, close to highways, close to jobs, and so on.
And you've seen a lot of change, as I mentioned in the intro, in the last decade since you've been in this position. Let's start from the beginning with your time here in San Francisco. What brought you to San Francisco to take on this role?
Well, it's an interesting question. I was in Seattle for about 9 years, and the two cities are very similar demographically and sort of the economies of the two cities. But I guess a couple of things attracted me here. One was Mayor Newsom, who was very interested in me coming down at the time. But I think more significantly is that the the city has a great legacy of good planning. I mean, going back many decades. I can remember very specifically when I was a young planner back in Pittsburgh, as you mentioned, looking at the city's downtown plan that was adopted in 1985. And that plan has been, I think, you know, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it's one of the great pieces of American city planning. Hmm. I mean, it created one of the best sort of core downtown areas in the U.S.
And what was the landscape like when you got here in 2008? Can you describe kind of what was going on in the city at the time with respect to planning and land use?
Well, it was the city was still the crash had not come. I got here right at the beginning of the year, so it was I was one of those like 27 applicants for the apartment that I ended up with, for example. And there was still that kind of rush, and there was a lot of development happening. But we were also in the tail end of doing a major series of neighborhood plans, the largest and still the largest of which was called the Eastern Neighborhoods Plan, which encompasses parts of South of Market, the Mission District, Dog Patch, and so on. And one of the major struggles at that time was how much of the city's industrial land, the land zoned for industrial land uses, should change to allow for other types of development, specifically housing and office development. And we ended up sort of splitting it half and half, if you will, at that time, and allowing about half of that land to be converted. And that was as soon as I got here, I got bombarded from both sides on that issue. Don't change it. Yes, change it. Get rid of all of it. Industry is moving out of the city. Why are you care about this? And since then, we've had a very strong policy as a city that we should protect the industrial land we have left, for example, because we think it provides jobs for people without college degrees. And the zoning of the land has an enormous influence on the value of the land and the value of what goes on that land.
And when you came here from Seattle, what were some of the things that maybe surprised you about San Francisco? In what ways was this, you know, a new and different experience from the other cities that you'd worked in?
Well, I was warned before I sat down in that chair that the land use politics in San Francisco are a bloody battle.
And worse than other cities?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's still the case.
Why here, not in Seattle or Pittsburgh?
It's a difficult question to answer. I think in many ways it's because people are fiercely protective of this place. Somebody described it to me as that people in San Francisco want it to be the same way it was the day they moved here, whether it was yesterday or 30 years ago. And they're fiercely protective for a very good reason. It's a spectacularly beautiful place and region.
Interesting, though, that maybe places like Seattle, I mean, I think Seattle's beautiful, too. It's surprising that you wouldn't have that same dynamic, at least up there. Nothing against our friends in Pittsburgh, but at least a West Coast.
Well, Pittsburgh's a very interesting city you should visit if you haven't. Seattle is, while the city is in years not that much older, it physically is much older, much newer than San Francisco. And much of the city is still on its first generation of buildings. And so it's a much less dense city than San Francisco, probably about a third of the density of San Francisco.
So maybe a little less precious to people than...
In some of the city. Now, that's changing dramatically with the very dramatic growth in Seattle as well, which has actually grown at a faster pace than San Francisco.
Yeah, and actually, I'd love to talk to you about that, too, if we have a little time at the end. We want to talk about all the San Francisco issues first, of course. So you've set the scene in terms of kind of culturally what you'd have to deal with here in terms of, you know, people really being invested in land use battles. Was there anything in terms of the governance structure, the rules and regulations, anything like that that surprised you when you came here?
What was interesting is that the way the governance structure of land use and development and planning works in San Francisco is a more common model across the country. Seattle was the exception to that. Seattle was quite different that way. In Seattle, the city council generally does not get involved in development decisions, and the planning commission has no role in approving projects. They're a policy body. So it's a very different construct than it is here. But that's actually the exception to the rule.
And why are they that way up there?
You know, it goes back a number of years. I really don't know, other than the fact that for the longest time, the authority to approve development projects rests with the head of the agency.
So it's all basically kind of bureaucratic public agency decision-making, not elected official decision-making on the land use planning.
That's right. Except when it comes to legislative changes like changing the zoning code, which is, of course, requires city council. But other than that, the council actually has voted to actually remove itself from much of the development process.
How does that change things that here in San Francisco you have elected officials and appointed planning commissioners making some of these, you know, very day-to-day basic decisions?
Right. No, it's very different here. It takes longer, to be frank, partially because of that. And it also it also creates a process where there's many layers and many bites at the apple. So there's obviously, and I don't think it's I'm speaking out of turn by saying it politicizes it more, and I think that's true. But it also there's a layer kind of protection that's built in, you know, in both a good and bad sense of that word, where there's many different layers of process that one must go through to get to the approval stage. Now, having said that, there's still a lot of small projects that we approve administratively, but the most visible projects and the larger projects go to the Planning Commission, and depending on their nature, are often to the Board of Supervisors.
I suppose this is a good example of maybe why we're lucky that you're retiring, so I can ask you some of these questions about the role of elected officials and all of this. But, I mean, I'm curious about those pros and cons. I mean, it seems like that really politicizes everything, and so elected officials might be viewing a new project in the prism of their immediate electoral interests rather than what's good for, you know, for the greater good of the city.
That's true. I don't think even they would argue that point. I think that's true. I mean, what's different, I think, one of the fundamental differences that I have found between the two cities is that land use and development is much higher in people's consciousness here than it is in perhaps anywhere else in the U.S.
Is that maybe because it's become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy? If elected officials have a say, then people suddenly realize they can lobby their supervisor or the mayor or whoever it is, the planning commissioner, to get involved even on a one single project.
That may be. But I also think, but interestingly enough, in Seattle, for example, before I got there, so it must have been in the mid-90s, the city council voted to essentially remove itself from much of the development process because they had more of a role, and they decided that it would be better to remove itself from the process. So it's an interesting question. I don't know I actually do think it goes back to sort of people's strong feelings about the character of this place and how attached they are to it.
And are there positives that you see having more involvement of elected officials, planning commissioners?
Sure. I mean, there is benefit to having, you know, multiple eyes on these things. I would argue that it gets a little too cumbersome. And that I wish we could streamline the process. We've been trying to do that in many ways, but it's we often get a lot of pushback to do that.
Do you prefer one system or the other? Do you think it's better to have, you know, not as much elected official involvement in specific?
Well, in an ideal world, if the codes worked the way they would, and there was still a heavily involved public process, which I absolutely think there needs to be, I think having elected officials less involved would be a good thing, to be frank. When I say elected officials, I'm not talking about planning commission. I'm talking about, you know, the actual elected bodies. I do think that, but that all depends on the systemic issues being addressed up front, and particularly on issues of public involvement.
And I probably should ask this towards the end, but I'm curious now, just since you're bringing up the different structures of governance here, if you could make some changes to the governance system in San Francisco to produce better outcomes for everybody, or maybe not for everybody, but for the greater good, let's say, what might be some of those changes you would make?
Well, if you assume that one of the goals is to actually produce more housing, and I do think we need to produce more housing, and we can argue about how much and where and what income levels, but if one of the goals is to get more housing built, for example, I would argue that it would be helpful if particularly smaller projects would have an easier approval path, so that we could approve smaller projects administratively, which is in fact what the vast majority of cities, even in California, do.
Right now there's a lot of discretion and multiple processes.
It's not based on the size of projects. It's based on where it is and what the specific use is and what the characteristics and many neighborhoods have different controls and that sort of thing.
And what's keeping that change from happening?
Strong belief that the process is important for people's involvement and for the involvement of elected officials.
And did you end up making changes to the San Francisco Planning Department? I mean, you've been there now for over 10 years. I mean, how have things changed since when you came in and now that you're on your way out?
Well, it's the most obvious change is that we've grown dramatically because our revenue base is based on income from development applications, right? So at the low point in the department's staffing when I got – went during the recession, I should say – was about 135 people. We're now at 240. So in 10 years, we've grown by 100 people. And that is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily related to the development approval process, if you will. We've also grown our policy side, though, and long-range planning side. And I think one of the most interesting things that's happened with us in the past decade, and I have to really give kudos to the community and to the mayors and, that I've worked with and the board who have supported this, which is that we have been become involved in a lot of issues that relate to how we use land. Sea level rise issues, for example, and transportation planning, and which I know is an interest of yours, and related issues and community stabilization, community development, which has become extremely important to me, issues that relate to our kind of traditional role, if you will, in planning and approving projects and zoning and that sort of thing, but issues that we can't ignore in light of all the changes that are happening and are around us.
It is pretty remarkable when you think of how much in the last 10 years has really changed here. But let's go back towards, you know, more closer to the beginning of when you got here in 2008, and you described a bit about, you know, what it was like coming here from Seattle and some of the immediate issues you're working on. But can you describe some of the specific challenges that San Francisco was facing when you arrived and how they've changed over time? Now, you've already kind of mentioned some of them, but, you know, we think about the housing shortage and gentrification. What were some of those big issues that you immediately, you know, started to grapple with and have had to continue grappling with, because they're not issues we're going to solve anytime soon?
I think anybody who's lived here for any length of time realizes that housing affordability has been an issue here for a very long time. In fact, I can remember an activist in Seattle telling me when I chose to move here, she said, if you think housing is unaffordable here, you're going to the worst place in the U.S. for that. And, you know, I get that. But all of those issues have become far more acute in the last since the turnaround of the recession, right? And compounded with issues of climate change and transportation demand. I think what we were not prepared for, to be honest, and I think this is true of most of my counterparts across the U.S., is the tremendous shift in living preferences by the baby boom generation and by millennials, who now want to much more commonly live in central cities than they did even a decade ago.
But isn't this a trend that we've been seeing for a number of decades now? Or, I mean, do you think it's really more acute in the last
I think it's more acute in the last year. And the reason that it's particularly hit us harder than perhaps other cities is because of the explosive growth of the technology industry and their hiring of the younger generation to come, and who is attracted to come here because partially and maybe exclusively because of the high salaries. And so those two things combined have created kind of a perfect storm for a city like San Francisco.
It also seems like a lot of those Silicon Valley companies that used to be comfortable in an office, giant office park down in Cupertino or Mountain View or something, they're moving into high rises now in San Francisco. That seems to be a new phenomenon. Is that right?
Yes, but I would argue it's because of where their employees want to live. It's like it's sort of exactly what happened in the 60s and 70s when residents were moving out of the city into the suburbs and the companies followed, and now the exact opposite is happening, right? Residents are their employees are moving into the city and the companies are following.
So they don't want to live in the suburbs down, you know, in San Jose and Silicon Valley. They want to be in the city.
Yeah, especially you know, millennial generation, they have a particular interest. They often don't have cars. They rely on bicycles or alternative modes of transportation. And it's clear. I mean, I've talked to companies, for example, who will get several times more applications for jobs that are in the city versus in their suburban offices.
You know, one thing that's always struck me, you know, being a Bay Area native and really recognizing how unique San Francisco is, but at the same time, you don't see other parts of the Bay build their own version of San Francisco. I mean, it seems like part of why the demand is so higher is because it's so unique, and it's not just the historical nature. It's the layout of the city. It's very pedestrian-friendly. It's got all that sort of charm and character, even with the newer buildings coming in some of these neighborhoods. So why don't other parts? Why didn't Silicon Valley build some San Francisco type neighborhoods down there so it would take pressure off of?
I think that it's a very good question. Some of them are getting at, because I think there is a growing understanding that creating a more pedestrian urbanized environment is attractive to a lot of people. But it's also, I think, the larger issue is why some of the smaller communities near those jobs are not building more housing. And I think that is a regional issue that we have to grapple with.
And in the meantime, we have seen a lot of job growth, correct,
right,
here in San Francisco?
Absolutely.
But not the commensurate housing growth?
We've seen a lot of job growth. And commensurate is an interesting word, but clearly we're out of balance. We need to do more of both.
And so when these decisions were made to let, say, Salesforce, you know, move into downtown Twitter in mid-market. Right. But there wasn't thought given to where these workers are going to be coming from?
Well, it's an interesting question. If you'll indulge me for a minute, we're often asked why do you approve all this housing that gentrifies the city? My response is because folks are moving here anyway, and they're moving here for the jobs. And so then the second question I often get is, why are you approving all these jobs in the city? And my response is that, number one, putting them in the city is putting them in the most transit-friendly location in the region. But I think secondly and more importantly is the realization, and I think we have to be really practical about this, is that those jobs would come to the region anyway. And if that office space wasn't in the city, it would be other places in the region, particularly on the peninsula, and presumably less and assuredly less transit-friendly locations, and the demand on housing would be the same.
Absolutely. I mean, San Francisco, we know, has the best transit in the Bay Area.
Right.
And so from that perspective alone, it would make sense. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. And we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing San Francisco urban planning with retiring planning director John Ram. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're opening the phone lines now. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page, but we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for San Francisco's planning director, John Ram? Do you live in a San Francisco neighborhood that's seen significant growth in the last decade? And what has that experience been like? And how do you think San Francisco should be preparing for its future? The number to call, again, is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Well, John, let me ask you about some of the major players that are involved in urban development in San Francisco, because as you mentioned, neighbors are very passionate, but who else is involved in this process? What are some of those, you know, big influential groups or individuals or stakeholders that influence these development
You mean
decisions?
Outside of city government itself?
Outside of this, although if you want to mention those in the city government too, that's of interest, but just generally among the public and the business community, et cetera.
Sure. I mean, it's obviously there are some large national and local developers here who have been players here for a long time and understand the city and have been very active in the city, particularly in the last decade. But there are also there's a very large nonprofit community here of kind of nonprofit housing developers who do affordable housing. There are advocacy organizations, and there are very vocal, particularly on the east side of the city, although I'm not exclusively certainly, there are very organized neighborhood organizations, some of which have become quite sophisticated in their review of development projects and their work with developers, and have become quite vocal both to work with developers and to oppose development, to support development if it meets certain criteria. Lots of those players now, and those groups are growing in their both their size and their sophistication and their knowledge of the process.
So they tend to be affordable housing advocates, tenant rights advocates. Or is that fair characterization?
All of that. Some of them are. It depends on where you're talking. Some neighborhoods have more of a focus on design, and so they work. They have architects in their neighborhood who work with developers to shape the design. Some neighborhoods are more focused on making sure there's community-serving activities in development or opposing development if it doesn't meet certain affordable housing requirements or concerns that they have. It varies across the board.
And do you see a fault line between those advocating for affordable housing and those, let's say, the YIMBY groups that might be more pro-market rate? You know, obviously pro affordable housing too, but do you see a fault line there, clashes that plays out in
clearly there's a clash there. I mean, there are called multiple groups that have been concerned about development, and I think that varies a little bit depending on the part of the city that you're in. That some of the folks cautious about development and growth are folks who are concerned about the amount of displacement and gentrification that's happened on the east side of the city. And they are pushing to create more growth on the west side of the city, for example. Other folks are concerned about change in their neighborhood, period, and are more have opposed new development in the city, no matter how much and where, right? So, not necessarily where, but as long as, you know, they'll say, you know, we need to build more housing, but not here. Right.
I think the expression is, NIMBY, not in my backyard, but there's also banana, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone.
Right, exactly.
There's caves, citizens against virtually everything. So we can put all these acronyms on those types.
Exactly.
But you don't see, do you see that this is playing out in a way that's thwarting housing production in terms of the those who advocate for affordable housing versus just housing of all types?
It's hard to say. I mean, whether it's thwarting production, I don't know. I do think that I take issue with some of the YIMBY's tactics, frankly, and some of the rhetoric. But I do think that what they have done is serve a purpose to actually raise consciousness about the need to build more housing. And I think that the level of the dialogue has changed a bit to where people – I think there is broader agreement that we need to increase housing supply. Where there is disagreement is how much and where and the type of housing and that sort of thing.
Yeah, how much of it should be affordable housing versus market rate. Well, let's go to the phone lines. We have Starchild calling in from San Francisco. Starchild, welcome back to City Visions.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. You know, I was just listening to your guest, John, talk about how we got there in 2008. There's about 130 employees at the San Francisco Planning Department. Now there's about 240. And I'm just thinking, you know, over 100 people, you know, working on administering regulations, 100 more in addition to whatever total is already there. Imagine if all those people had actually been involved in building housing instead of administering regulations and how much their presence there is costing the city. You know, I figure probably at least $150,000 a year per person when you figure in benefits, pensions, and everything times 100 people per year. You know, imagine all that money actually going to building housing or doing something else that directly benefit people. Friedrich Hayek, the Nobel Prize laureate, said planning, government planning, is basically the forcible superseding of other people's plans. And I think that that's something you should keep in mind and question how much benefit we're really getting from this whole process.
I think Starchild is an excellent question. So, what value are we getting from having a bigger planning staff? I mean, how can we, as taxpayers, you know, those of us who live in San Francisco, how should we feel about where the tax dollars are going, where the permit dollars are going, fees, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks, Starchild. It's good to hear from you. Haven't seen you at the Planning Commission lately. I think a couple of things. One is that the department is something like only 5% of the department is tax dollars. 5% of our revenues come from tax dollars. The rest, the vast majority comes from permit fees. But the second thing I think is important to mention is the reason the department has grown is not because we're putting projects through more hoops, but because the number of projects has grown exponentially in the last decade. I mean, literally, during the peak of the boom, that we were growing by double digits every year just in the sheer number of projects that were coming forward. So, you can argue about the level of regulation and everything that we do to review projects, but really it's just about the sheer number of projects that have come forward. I mean, at any given time, there's about 1,000 projects now in the department.
Well, I guess maybe to Starchild's point, are there opportunities to streamline this that you could do within the planning department? I imagine some of it's out of your control because you have to follow the laws as they are and you need staff to check all those boxes for any project that comes in the door. But are there ways that we could try to get more productivity out of the agency?
We are working on it. We've been working on it for quite some time. It's one of those things, however, that because of the legal process, there isn't a silver bullet that I can say, oh, if we just did that, we would cut the time in half. There's 100 things we have to do. And we actually have a spreadsheet of those 100 things that we're working on one step at a time.
And I assume you presented those to the board.
We did that about 2.5 years ago when Mayor Lee issued an executive directive asking us to speed up the process and to speed up the number of units that we approve every year.
And is Mayor Breed on a similar page?
Absolutely, even more so. I mean, she has embraced that executive directive and has asked us to be even stronger in our approach to streamlining this work.
Now, if your proposal to make smaller projects more streamlined, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, would that change the kind of staffing we would need?
It would, because we spend a disproportionate amount of our time on smaller projects. It's not commensurate to the size of the project. So it would allow us to spend more of our time on larger projects that actually produce more housing.
And what is a typical role that one of your staff members might be playing? I mean, when we have these people who are hired because we have more projects, why do we need them there to
Well, there's California has something called the California Environmental Quality Act, which is CEQA. So virtually everything has to go through that process. San Francisco, and this is where I'll get into the weeds a bit, but because everything in San Francisco is what's called discretionary from a legal standpoint. There's no administrative approval from a technical standpoint. Everything, therefore, has to go through a CEQA process.
But that's a self-imposed choice by the city. It doesn't have to be discretionary.
By the city legal, but that's the way our ordinances work. And so virtually everything has to go through some level of CEQA review.
Even a small...
I have 35 people who just do CEQA review.
And so just even a two-unit, three-unit, one-unit project.
And technically that CEQA review might be just a checklist of items, but technically that's the legal review of a document under CEQA.
So what percentage of the planning department time do you think, you know, if you just ballpark it, is devoted to the CEQA process?
It's about 35 people out of, what, 240.
So that's a pretty significant amount.
Absolutely.
So if the city were to make more decisions by right, not discretionary, that would essentially save... You know,
right. And so recently, because of some state law changes, we are able to approve affordable housing projects without CEQA review because they are by law administrative only. And so that has reduced our time to approve affordable projects by about 70%.
All right. So, Star Child, you should feel happy about that. Thank you for calling in. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. And we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we are discussing San Francisco's urban planning with retiring planning director John Ram. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The phone lines are open. And the number to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. And you can tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page, and we'll look for any questions that you have there. But we want to hear from you. If you live in San Francisco and you're concerned about the direction your neighborhood is going in or not going in, and you'd like to know what the plans might be, you can call in and ask Planning Director John Ram for what is in the cards for your part of the city or for the city as a whole. Again, 866-798-TALK. So let's go to the phone lines. Again, we have Valerie calling from right here in San Francisco. Valerie, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. And John, I'm really glad to be able to have an opportunity to speak with you because I have sort of unexpressed angst and upset about how the developers tricked the city vis-a-vis the church and market housing that is designated basically medium-term housing for visiting executives as opposed to adding to the housing stock. So I really feel like the developers pulled a fast one on the city on that one. And additional question related to how the planning department is going to mitigate the pressures that the mayor may be giving vis-a-vis South of Market development that she is interested in having more office space when the nonprofit Todco recognizes and understands that what we really need is affordable housing units in South of Market and that the gentrification wheels are turning at a very, very rapid pace in this area, and how the planning department can act as a mitigating factor between those two opposing but obviously unequal visions for housing development and development in general in the South of Market area.
All right. Well, Valerie, thank you for raising those questions. I'll let John respond in a second, but I will just note that you are highlighting some of the themes that we were talking about just in the first half hour here on the show. So, John, what's your response to Valerie's questions?
Thank you, Valerie, for those questions. That's a very thoughtful question. The church and market development is an interesting little recent development where they announced that they would do only – they were master leasing to an organization that rents essentially longer-term rentals, 30 days or more, which by the city's definition, by most cities' definition, constitutes a normal tenancy. So that is an interesting twist that has recently happened in the city, given the kind of the nature of residential demand in the city. I guess I would go back to, regarding the South of Market, I'd go back to my earlier point, Valerie, which is that I admittedly the city is producing a lot of office space and is creating a job base in those offices that need to be that the city and the region needs to address that housing problem. The challenge that I have is, number one, if it wasn't in the city, it would be in a less transit friendly place, number one, and number two, it would happen in the region anyway. If that office space did not occur in the South of Market or in San Francisco, it would happen elsewhere in the region, in Santa Clara or Cupertino or Mountain View or wherever. And the the demand for housing would still be there, and the demand for housing would still be in the city. So I do think it's important to look at this as a regional basis, and it's something we have not done in this region. There are 101 municipalities in this region that are independently in control of land use and development. 101. It's not the nine counties. It's 101, and San Francisco is only one of that 101. And every one of them is controlling their own land use and development destiny, which is one of the reasons, frankly, why the state and why Sacramento is thinking that it should step in and create some more uniform standards around this issue.
Well, let's talk about that. And Valerie, thank you for raising those questions. But so what is the state? Well, first of all, I think your point is well taken that we have all these little fiefdoms, the sort of artificial jurisdictions created around the Bay Area that all have this authority over what housing goes where and what jobs come in or don't come in. So what is the city's position with respect to what the state is doing? And maybe just as a threshold question, can you describe a bit about what's happening now at the state level?
There was something like 120 housing bills proposed last year. But a dozen of those did not go forward. But the kind of gist of what many of those bills were about is to, was to kind of require cities to either create minimum zoning or minimum kind of size of development. The most controversial was SB 50, what Senator Wiener put forward, which would essentially change the zoning around transit stations and create a minimum height, minimum densities within a quarter and a half mile around major transit stops.
So basically overriding local restrictions on density and height and parking requirements right next to major transit stops.
That's right.
And what was the city's position on that effort?
The city, I think the board officially passed a resolution against that particular bill. But I think the concept is an interesting one that we should look at. Not that we should do that exact regulation, but if I was sitting in the room with Scott Wiener, what I would suggest is that he focus on areas that have not met some housing targets and also focus on commercial corridors, both within the city and outside of the city. Because, for example, in many areas outside of the city, commercial corridors don't even allow housing and zoning, which makes no sense. It's where the transit exists, right? So I think there needs to be a little more nuanced in terms of its approach to places that are building more housing versus places that are not building housing. And I think it needs to be more nuanced in its location of how it works. But the basic idea that zoning should reflect transportation transportation lines and transportation stops is the right one.
It seems like a no-brainer. If you're going to spend billions of dollars for a transit line, you should have people within walking distance, option to live and work right there. And that bill, SB 50, by the way, will be coming up for a vote in January on the state Senate floor. So,
I think it's actually they're looking at a third version of it. They're looking at a recent round of changes. It was reported that Senator Wiener is meeting with actually planning agencies across the state right now to look at how it might be changed into something that's more workable.
So he's San Francisco State Senator. So if you'd like to call into Scott Wiener, you can look him up if you live here in the city. Even if you don't, I'm sure he'd be interested in hearing from you. We've had him on the show before as a guest. The real issue here is about gentrification and housing affordability. And what's your view on what causes that and why that's been such a big problem here in San Francisco?
Well, first of all, what I will say is that there's a big difference between gentrification and displacement. And those words are often used interchangeably. But gentrification is basically the phenomenon of higher income folks moving into a lower income and raising the overall income level of a neighborhood or a district. Displacement is when that phenomenon of gentrification leads to people being displaced, either physically or more commonly economically displaced, right? And the latter issue is something that I think we need and can get a better handle on, right? I can't tell someone they can't move here if they're higher income, nor should I be able to. On the other hand, I think the city needs to do a much better job, it's become one of my kind of strong passions, much better job on addressing displacement and kind of the stabilization of our neighborhoods and keeping people in their homes and businesses.
And as you mentioned, though, all the offices that are being constructed here means you have more of that job growth. And if we're not building enough housing to balance it, I mean, isn't it just inevitable? There's only so much you can do to try to stem that tide if we're not fundamentally soaking up some of that you know, the new demand, the new arrivals coming here to work for these tech companies, financial services, and you know, all of their big areas of growth.
No, there's no question that we need to build the housing. And you know, for example, that Central SoMa plan we talked about with all the housing, all the office also has 9,000 housing units that will be built in that plan area. But I mean, I think it's it's the growth and the growth of the population with higher income population, and that is causing the displacement to happen, right? So it's not the buildings that cause the impact, it's people.
It's the demand.
It's the demand.
The new people arriving here in San Francisco has always been a pretty high growth area since
And by the way, the city's housing stock has never kept up with population growth.
And so it also is, as you mentioned, a regional problem. And
yes.
What would you recommend, if not a state-level solution, you know, like a SB 50 that you mentioned, what could be done maybe regionally to have better coordination among all the different cities and counties?
Well, we do have, as a result of a bill called SB 375, which was adopted maybe 7 or 8 years ago, the requirement for a regional plan, right, which we are now in the ABAG, Association of Bay Area Governments, and Metropolitan Transportation Commission, excuse me, is now working on the third version of that plan, which basically tries to direct most housing and office growth near transit. Excuse me.
And that bill is actually authored by now Mayor of Sacramento, Daryl Steinberg.
That's right.
Back in 2008, but I know San Francisco didn't have to really comply until a few years after that. Has that made a difference at all, the regional plan?
It's made anything? A difference in terms of the actual – only in terms of the messaging around it. The problem is that the regional plan has no real teeth. It doesn't require cities to only approve projects, for example, near transit. It just says, here's where you should build projects near transit.
So what kind of teeth do we need then to make regional governing?
I would argue there's a lot more we could do around codifying the regional plans that the state is requiring us to approve. I would argue, for example, that we should be stronger in our requirements to require that new office development be near transit. And in fact, that's one of the things that does not come up very often, but I think we could go a long way to solving our transportation problem if we built new office development near transit and outside of the city.
So we certainly do see a lot of job sprawl in the Bay Area.
Absolutely.
As it is. So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing San Francisco's urban planning and the future of the city with retiring planning director John Ram. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation and ask questions of John is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, and we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about your neighborhood in San Francisco or growth of the city in general or what the state or regional entities governing the Bay Area in general should be doing to address some of these critical issues of housing shortage, housing affordability, et cetera. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us or post a comment on our Facebook page. So I have to ask you one question that makes a lot of headlines, or at least it should make headlines, which is the high cost of building units. And you know, maybe this is why we've seen a number of approved housing units in the city. Like, I think it's 40,000 were approved or have been approved, but only 8,500 are under construction. So can you describe what some of these challenges to actually getting these units built seems to be, and particularly why is it so expensive to build in San Francisco?
It's a very good question. I'm not sure I really know the answer to that. Since we rely primarily on the private sector to build and to finance their own projects. But the numbers have changed a little bit and have gotten somewhat worse, frankly, Ethan. So we've approved 55,000 housing units. There's about 9,000 under construction. And I think anecdotally, what I hear is one of the issues is a labor shortage in the construction industry, and that was somewhat caused by many in the construction industry leaving the region during the recession, when construction jobs plummeted dramatically, and have not been able to come back, ironically, because of the cost of housing.
So we're sort of spiraling now down the drain.
Yeah. Now, I mean, look, that's an anecdotal. I'm sure there's been any formal research on that, but that's one of the issues I hear. I also hear, obviously, the trade war with China is causing materials to increase in price. And other factors, land costs, everything, because of the economy of the city growing so much, everything is is growing in cost.
Do you have any sense of the breakdown between hard costs, you know, the labor costs, supplies, land, versus the soft costs, you know, the environmental review that you talked about and planning? I mean, how much of the price per door to build a unit in San Francisco is hard versus soft?
I'm sure developers will argue with me about this, but I don't think our cost in terms of our process and our environmental review and all this stuff has dramatically increased. In fact, we haven't actually raised fees other than the cost of the CPI for several years.
And the amount of time to approve a unit.
Yeah,
hasn't changed.
I mean it hasn't really changed. It's probably gone down a bit, frankly. So I think it's hard costs and land costs that have dramatically increased. And also, I have to say, the city has increased our inclusionary housing fees. So the requirement for projects to have more affordable housing on site, which I totally get, which everybody makes sense, but that does obviously increase the cost of housing development.
So then you get a dynamic where only the most sort of high-end luxury units are going to pencil out. Is that accurate?
Well, it appears to be happening, although it's interesting because I also see new projects being built all the time, right? I mean, you know, several months ago the number was 8,500 under construction. Now it's something like 93 or 9,400. So it's obviously projects are moving ahead. But
they tend to be more high-end?
Many of them are, and what I hear is that the condos are now make more sense than rental because, ironically, even though rents are ridiculously high, they haven't really gone up dramatically in about 3 years. And strangely enough, the fact that construction costs are increasing and rents aren't actually makes projects less feasible. Now, one could say it's a good thing that the rents haven't been raised, but with construction costs continuing to rise, it actually inhibits new supply.
And I think a lot of people are sensitive and open to the idea of inclusionary housing, that
sure,
we should
of course
require affordable units. But isn't that essentially putting the cost of new affordable units on those new arrivals to the city or those people who are going to buy those units or rent those units? I mean, shouldn't that be a cost that the city as a whole bears rather than those newcomers?
Do you have about 4 hours to have this discussion? I mean, we could debate this forever. I mean, there's very strong feelings on both sides. Some believe we should remove all inclusionary fees and do a citywide parcel tax to fund affordable housing. There's any number of different beliefs on this issue. I think fundamentally what the inclusionary housing requirements are about is saying that new residents to the city that move into new buildings create an impact that actually increases the demand for affordable housing.
And I guess politically it's easier to tax those who aren't yet in their home and aren't renting their unit than to ask everyone to contribute to
Well, and also legally it's possible to do this with development. I mean, when you think about it, right, it's actually the cost is borne by development, not by just like new residents coming into the city, right? It's actually the development that's actually bearing that cost, rightly or wrongly. I mean,
that's helpful to think about the inclusionary housing debate. I know this is a big one, and it does sound like from what you were saying that the high inclusionary percentages is creating a bit of a chilling effect.
I need to qualify that a bit, right? Most of what's under construction was approved. The vast majority of what's under construction was approved before the inclusionary rates were raised.
So what do you think then is causing? Is it the high costs that's causing this lag between the number of approved units versus what's actually under construction?
It's the construction costs primarily from what I can gather.
Well, let's talk about another concern with new development, and that is, and I hear this from people, well, if we're going to allow these new residents to come in these new apartment buildings, then how are we going to pay for all the infrastructure impacts? It's going to mean Muni's going to get more crowded. We're going to need more schools. We already have a dearth of open space. How do you respond to people who object to new housing saying we just can't support it with the infrastructure that we have?
I think the points are extremely well taken. The area that is most dramatic in that respect is transportation, because the costs of improving the transportation system are so dramatic. We are able, in the areas where we have done plans, such as the Transbay area and the South of Market, we have been able to, through impact fees and fees on development, been able to address many of the other needs, such as open space and community facilities and such, in ways that are surprising. I mean, you'd be surprised at how much open space we've actually added to the city's pool. Transportation is a much tougher nut to crack because number one, there is a huge backlog of demand that's in the hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars. And number two, we can only charge development by state law for the impact that development creates. So I can only charge you as a developer for the 1,000 people that are in your building. I can't charge you to make up for the demand from 5,000 other people, for example.
Well, is there a maximum to what our existing transportation infrastructure can handle? I mean, we're not going to be building a whole new subway line just with a couple new housing projects coming in.
That's right.
So we've got the Muni system we have. We have the BART system. You know, we're barely building the Central Subway. That's, you know, going to take over a decade and, you know, over $1 billion to go just a bit over a mile.
Sure.
So what are the solutions then to address the transportation impacts from new residents and new workers too?
No, I mean, the answer to that question is really dollars. Right. I mean, there is a strong will to actually improve and grow the transportation system, but there is the need to improve the system that we have to make it run more efficiently, clearly, and Muni, I think, is going a long ways to doing that right now. But expanding the system is extraordinarily expensive.
And does the planning department have a role to play in lower cost solutions? I mean, not just trying to dig more tunnels, and I think, you know, arguably we do need more subway extensions around San Francisco, but do you play a role in, say, you know, a lane down Market Street, whether that's going to be for automobiles versus buses? Because it seems like we could make better use of our existing landscape to move more people more quickly.
Yes, we actually do play a role in a couple of different ways. One is that we are leading the city's transportation planning, the very long-term transportation planning. In fact, we're doing a 50-year look out into the city's growth to see what kind of transportation system we should end up with, called Connect SF, and that we've led an interdepartmental effort on that basis. But we're also very much involved with MTA and Public Works and our sister agencies on issues exactly like you mentioned, like Market Street, which will now be, you know, which in the near future will be closed to private automobiles, for example, increasing the MTA capacity. The goal of that's design was to increase MTA capacity by, I think, 15% on that street, for example.
And is there a role for the planning department in making some of these other big-picture projects, you know, whether it's bringing high-speed rail into the Transbay Terminal, which right now is just a bus station, basically,
right,
or maybe trying to make sure the Central Subway can be built faster and cheaper? Is there things that the planning department can do to speed up these major infrastructure projects and make them less costly?
That's a question that the answer would be probably no, only in the sense that those projects, they have such a high capital cost, right? The Central Subway is, what, $1.5 billion project, right? And but the payoff in the end is great. I mean, people talk about low tech solutions, but I always love the analogy that BART uses, that twice as many people go under the bay every day as over the bay. On the Bay Bridge, because there's hundreds of thousands of people that use BART every day, and you simply I don't know of any low tech solution that could come close to carrying those numbers of people.
So we'll probably need a second tube at some point.
Absolutely, and BART is now looking at that.
Well, speaking of the Bay, we haven't talked about climate change so much, although you mentioned it as an issue. But sea level rise, what is the city doing to plan for what, you know, scientists are saying we could be facing a 9-foot sea level rise by 2100, which is in the lifetime of some of the kids running around the San Francisco today, possibly up to 11 feet, depending on some of the major ice sheets. That is a huge impact for a city that is surrounded on three sides by ocean water.
I think it's a hugely important question, and it's one of those things that when I started this job, we weren't even thinking about. But to his credit, Mayor Lee asked us to co-chair the city's sea level rise task force with the port, and it's now we co-chair that with the city's Office of Resilience and Capital Planning, and looking at a whole number of issues specifically around sea level rise. We have just completed what's called a vulnerability analysis that looks at all of the city's own capital facilities, so MTA and PUC and Public Works and all those agencies, so that we look at what city facilities are most vulnerable and what should be addressed most upfront, if you will. It's interesting. The large private development that's on the Bay, for example, the recently approved developments at Pier 70 and Mission Rock, those projects on their own volition are raising the height of their land. But that doesn't do much if the streets around them are 6 feet lower, right, and are affected by sea level rise. So we're going to have to address these issues. We are taking a very important step with this first analysis, and the next step is to figure out where the city should be spending its dollars to get the biggest buck. The other, of course, is the biggest impact, I should say. The other, of course, is the seawall, and the port is in a very strategic effort to rebuild the city's seawall, which is not only seismically vulnerable, but also, of course, would have to be addressed in any discussion of sea level rise.
So do you think if we were to go in a time capsule in the 2100, would San Francisco essentially be a walled city to try to, in Netherlands style, fend off the
It's hard to know. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what the result will be. I think there are some pretty innovative solutions out there that don't involve just building walls, but perhaps in some cases receding the land. The land will be receded inward, in some cases going farther out. The original natural topography of the city before we hardened the edge of the city was much more forgiving when it came to things like storm surge and sea level rise. And there's a pretty strong sense that we could do some of that again. We'd actually could address the problem.
Well, one more thorny issue. That's just a brief bit on climate change, but racial equity. I know that you've launched some racial equity programs, and this is a big issue in terms of demographic change in the city and
Absolutely.
Trying to preserve diversity here. What's happening along those lines here through the planning department?
Well, we've been So about 5 or 6 years ago, we started some work specifically at that time focused on the Mission District, which we thought was the neighborhood that was most vulnerable to displacement and the economic inequities that were happening in the city. And we did a lot of work with the Latino community in the Mission to create a kind of whole menu, if you will, of stabilization strategies. That has evolved into a citywide community stabilization strategy where we're trying to create kind of menus that are focused on each neighborhood. In parallel with that, we're in the process of developing our own racial equity plan in the department, which, by the way, now the mayor and the board have just passed legislation requiring every department to do that. But we were, I have to admit, we were kind of ahead of the game on that. We focused our first phase on our internal practices, and our second phase, more challenging, is going to be how we face and how we address racial equity issues in our outward-facing work, our public-facing work. We'll be starting a whole public discussion around that. But I think it goes hand in hand with the economic inequality issues, right? And we have to look at those things in connection with each other.
So we've just got less than 2 minutes left. So I have to ask you, looking back now, as you end near the end with your retirement coming up, what do you see as the greatest success of your tenure as planning director and your biggest regret?
Well, I mean, I would argue a couple of great successes. I'm really proud of the Transit Center plan that focused a tremendous amount of development and growth around the new Transit Center downtown, and it has been built out in an incredibly short period of time. Our timing was perfect. I'd like to say we planned it that way. It was the turnaround of the economy that did that. But I'm also extremely proud of what I was just mentioning, the work in the Mission and the community stabilization strategy, because the way I like to think about it is that we have traditionally spent 90% of our time on 10% of the city. And this is where we're trying to spend more time on the other 90%. So I'm really proud of that work. My regret is not starting that work much sooner and not getting ahead of the game a little bit on this economic growth.
And any words of wisdom for the next planning director who fills your shoes?
Continue that work and start looking at the West Side.
All right. And for you personally, what are your future plans?
I'm going to take some time off and just relax. And I'd like to, as I think I was saying earlier, maybe I'd like to get involved in some 50,000-foot level and do some teaching and some writing and some really delving into these issues that are really affecting cities across the world right now. The issues that we're facing are pretty common in every city in the world right now.
We certainly see it in other places, and at Los Angeles and Seattle, where you came from before San Francisco. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and we're going to have to leave it there. But first of all, it's good to hear that you've got some thinking and some planning to do, a planning of your own in terms of how you can continue to make a positive difference. And thank you for your service to the city and county of San Francisco as planning director. So my guest tonight was John Ram, planning director for the city and county of San Francisco, and that's City Visions for this evening. But thank you so much, John, for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Ethan.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, you can visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show is produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next week. We'll be discussing the upcoming November 5th election as San Francisco voters go to the polls, and they will be deciding who the next district attorney will be. So that's an exciting discussion Monday night at 7 o'clock here on City Visions. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.